Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We're going to talk about the world. A world of hurt is the way I think of it. A world that may be in the opening phases of World War III, for that matter. And to talk about this, I'm very pleased to say we have with us one of our duty experts, a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, a man of great accomplishment as a member of the United States Army's Special Operations Team, a specialist in psychological warfare during his time in uniform, and then as a senior civilian in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, among other government entities. His name is Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired. He is the author of a terrific new book entitled The Nation Will Follow. We're always glad to catch up with him, especially, John, at a time such as this. Welcome back, sir, to Securing America.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. Always an honor to be on your
thank
show.
Thank you. John, you have been at the forefront with our Committee on the Present Danger of China, of which you're an important member, arguing for enhancing deterrence to the Chinese communists, now increasingly preparing, not just talking about, but preparing for military action against Taiwan and perhaps others, including ourselves. Some things are being done, even by the Biden administration, surprisingly enough. Give us a sit rep, if you will, a situation report on how you see that, and is it enough?
Yeah, thank you, Frank. These were things that should have been done several years ago. Trump was moving us that direction. And we've had voluminous recommendations from the Committee on Present Danger to build deterrence now. The more we sweat now and build deterrence, the less likely there will be conflict. This is our conflict. For when the Chinese move, it's not about Taiwan anymore. It's about us. Sovereign American territory will receive missile strikes. This is very serious. So I don't want to be an alarmist, but we have to be honest and clear and realistic. For them to move on Taiwan, they have to hit Guam, Tinian, Saipan, and Hawaii. That's American territory. We are now, the Biden team, there are U.S. forces ashore in Taiwan, in addition to a growing special operations training capacity to teach the Taiwanese special operators and organize an armed ready reserve. We now have conventional forces acting as a tripwire, somewhere between a battalion and brigade-sized army element. And the Biden team just formally asked to store significant ammunition stocks in Taiwan.
Wow. This is relatively new news, and certainly, as far as I'm concerned, good news. Because as you say, John, if we can deter this conflict, that is vastly to be preferred. If we learned anything from the Ukraine debacle, it is trying to fix the problem after it's gone critical is not desirable. John, I wanted to ask you about all of this in the context, speaking of Ukraine, of the visit recently by Xi Jinping, the emperor, if you will, of communist China to Moscow, what you saw coming out of that and its implications for this so-called no limits partnership between the Russians and the Chinese Communist Party.
Of all the experts we have inside this administration, air quotes, and at the Ivy League institutions, I'm puzzled and flummoxed by the lack of reaction. When Xi goes to Moscow and says change is in the air, and something that has been seen in 100 years, this is significant and we need to pay attention. And this is right after they pulled the coup of establishing a peace relationship, again, air quote, we'll see how that works out, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and a deal for Saudi oil priced in yuan, the Chinese currency. This is incredible. This is the most destabilizing activity to the dollar as the world reserve currency. And the only thing the administration does is blink and it states, says, Mr. Xi, please tell Mr. Putin he's now been indicted for war crimes, Mr. Xi. Could you please do that, please, Mr. Xi? I mean, this is pathetic. And the world is changing rapidly. And this administration is very mixed, confused, and doing a few good things, but many confusing and wrong things simultaneously.
John, I mentioned that you're a specialist in psychological operations and affecting people's thinking. There is no question that this behavior on the part of our administration, set aside for the moment some late and welcome action on Taiwan, apparently, but in terms of more generally, how they are engaging, how they are responding to these developments. And it's not just with respect to Russia or China and Russia for that matter, it's North Korea as well, which is now daily exercising capabilities to attack our friends and allies and setting the stage, I fear, for doing just that. Probably as part of this offensive that may be coming from China. You mentioned Iran. Talk a little bit about, you know, the seeming capacity now of the Iranians to actually have the nuclear weapons that we, among others, have said relentlessly we would never let them acquire. All of this seems to bode very, very ill for the kinds of stability that we've sought and have benefited from over the years. Change in the air, indeed.
Yeah, the elites at the Council on Foreign Relations and CSIS and all these other think tanks always want to talk about stability, yet they're doing everything opposite that they're doing everything that, that creates instability. And they just, some of them are bought off, corrupt, playing for the other team. Some of them are just totally ignorant of reality, and they're producing the exact effects they say they don't want. Well, then why are they doing everything to produce these destabilizing effects? The dollar as the reserve currency is a good thing, and yet the Biden team just seems bent on giving it away. Xi feels emboldened to move. Now, he has horrific problems at home as far as the population, a rapidly declining population. He's eliminated all opponents. It's totally, everybody's a yes man or woman to whatever he says. Just, they can't feed themselves, a horrific need for food, for energy. Their exports are just collapsing. Nothing, they had an uprising, they just squashed. And so it compels them. The question is, General Minahan says 2025, I'm concerned Xi will be compelled to move faster than 2025.
Among other reasons for these domestic internal ones, totalitarians usually at some point default to external threats or external activities, aggression, if you will, to tamp down those domestic problems and justify doing so. John, so much is of concern here. You mentioned this issue of the Saudis now lining up with the Chinese and moving against effectively the petrodollar. One of the things that I think is very concerning is they've also now apparently decided they want to become part of the so-called BRICS arrangement, which has had as a central purpose. This is assorted countries, the Chinese, the Russians, the Brazilians, the South Africans, the Indians, all of whom seem to have had a central purpose trying to displace the reserve currency status of the dollar. We'll talk a little bit more about that and other groupings that are of concern in this World War III potential environment with John Mills right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Biden administration has a plan for the next pandemic or other public health emergency of international concern. Make it worse. In fact, one might, like Lenin, say, the worse, the better. That would be the effect of surrendering our sovereignty over declaring and responding to such events to an unaccountable proto-world government doing business as the UN's World Health Organization. Never mind the WHO recommended disastrous policies during the COVID-19 pandemic that helped kill over 1 million Americans. Yesterday, Senator Ron Johnson tried to ensure the U.S. Senate would be able to vote down the disastrous agreement with the WHO that Team Biden is secretly negotiating. His Democratic colleagues blocked him. As a result, we now have no choice but to withdraw from the World Health Organization before it finishes off more of us and our constitutional republic. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and John Mills, Colonel of the United States Army, retired, is in the House, the author of The Nation Will Follow, and a very prolific contributor in other platforms to the public policy debate about the state of our national security and the country more generally. And John, I want to thank you for all of that work, including that you do with our Committee on the Present Danger China as one of its important members, as well as a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy. And I specifically want to just invite you to talk a little bit about these other instruments, if you will, that the Chinese have been mobilizing and seemingly increasingly weaponizing. I talked a little bit about this BRICS group. But there's also, John, this 147 or so member Belt and Road Initiative that is being used by the Chinese to essentially build out a colonial infrastructure for not just, you know, tying various countries and markets to them, but also from which to project power. It's having some difficulties too, as are the Chinese more generally, but how do you see all of these things aligning in terms of threats to our country and the need for us to be restoring a policy of peace through strength?
Well, this is part of their unrestricted warfare campaign, as opposed to the Soviets, who just wanted to stare us down militarily. They did run insurgencies, and they did run domestic influence operations in the U.S., but the Chinese have perfected this to a much higher art form. So, you know, number one, destabilize the United States. Fentanyl, open border, they're exploiting that. Now connections between fentanyl and the Sinaloa cartels, and it's now collapsing because there's other cartels that are rising. But violence in America, the crazy cults of transgenderism, all those have fingers. But it's also the Belt and Road is the influence campaign against other nations. And they've been quite successful in a number of places of putting inroads. And again, it points to the ineffectiveness of our State Department to counter even under the horrific leadership that's going on right now. They're trying to pivot to this. They fought the Trump administration on this, but the State Department needs to get better. I mean, we need just to totally redo the State Department. The common complaint at State Department, we don't have the funding. A lot of this is not about funding. It's about communicating resolve and interest. And they are doing horribly at that. A lot of these, again, it's not about money. We have the tools of the dollars, the reserve currency, trade deals, trade sanctions. We have a lot of power and tools in the toolkit. Just everybody saying, I need more money is not the answer. We have a lot of tools that they are not leveraging. They're trying to pivot to it, but this is stuff they should have been doing 10 years ago. And a lot of it is just simple interest in the local nation. And a lot of times these ambassadors in charge of affairs, they need to rethink how they come across, because most of them are very horrible about advancing an American agenda in the countries where they're located.
Yeah, John, you know, I guess one of the things that worries me about what you've said, and I don't disagree with it, but it's the case that you have to start from the position of wanting to do something to strengthen your country, to ensure its power and capabilities. And more or less everything I see the administration doing is weakening us, and frankly is benefiting especially the CCP. Prime example of which I wanted to just bounce off of you quickly is this World Health Organization gambit. As you know, John, the World Health Organization did an enormous amount of damage on behalf of what I think is rightly described as sort of their master, the Chinese Communist Party, during pandemic 1.0. That's when it just had advisory power. The administration is now seeking to give it the power to actually dictate to us what constitutes a public health emergency of international concern, as it's called, and what we must do to respond to it. And the agreements that are coming out of this, there are two possible outcomes here, both bad, especially if in combination, a treaty and some amendments to existing regulations. Senator Ron Johnson asked the Senate yesterday to insist that whatever comes out of this process of possibly surrendering our sovereignty to this organization be submitted to the Senate for its advice and consent pursuant to our, you know, constitutional treaty-making powers. The Democrats opposed him and defeated that amendment. So it looks as though if we remain in this entity, we're going to be told by the people who brought us a great deal of harm. We'll talk more about that shortly with Dr. Peter McCullough. To do infinitely more in the future. Give us your thoughts on what's going on here and how this fits into the larger problem, really, with what this administration is up to.
Yeah, heroic leadership out of Senator Johnson. Good for him. It's a total failure of the Senate. They have essentially surrendered and abandoned their constitutional duty to oversight. And again, advice and consent of the Senate on what amounts to treaties. Now, and I've seen this over and over again beyond the WHO situation, which absolutely that amounts to a treaty. But what they did, the game they play, and I've seen this over and over again when I've been at the White House and the Office of Secretary of Defense, is they'll belittle and quibble. And well, this doesn't quite rise to the level of a treaty. And that is just it is intentional.
It's rubbish.
It is trying to horse dump. It is really wrong. And no, we need to hammer this. And the Senate needs to do their job. And that is shameful. And we need to bring this up again and again. And they're saying, oh, that's just regulatory guidance that doesn't rise to the level of a treaty. Rubbish. Silliness. Wrong.
If it involves surrendering our sovereignty, you bet it does. And John, I've come to the conclusion, as I think a growing number of us have, is at this point, it's not enough just to have a treaty process undertaken. We need to get out of this organization.
It's a corrupt organization.
Before they are able to impose on us their mandates. Corrupt would be one thing. I fear it is really malevolent and just the sort of stalking horse for global government that would be absolutely antithetical to our interests, including our security interests, would it not?
Yeah, I mean, the WHO, now the elites just love the WHO, and it just, oh, that's so wonderful that we, no, it's not wonderful. You look at this, I mean, the Chinese percentage of what we contribute, I would suggest we contribute a far larger share of the WHO budget, and yet China calls the shots in the WHO. Come on. I mean, it is patently obvious who is running the WHO. And it's not Hu Jintao, it's the CCP. And this is just absolute silliness on and it's not it's evil and it is malign, and we need to, they say, oh, stop beating up on the WHO. No, I'm sorry, this is a totally dysfunctional influence operation. Well, it's an effective influence operation run by the CCP. Get out of it.
And control is what they have in mind for us, not just in the public health space, as we'll talk about with Dr. Peter McCullough. Incredible damage has already been done under the auspices of this advisory role of the WHO, but also, of course, by our own government and the biopharmaceutical complex, as Dr. McCullough calls it. John, we have to leave it at that for the moment. So much more to talk with you about, but thank you for giving us such important context for the day's thinking about the challenges we face and what we need to do about them. I know you'll keep up the great work you do. Congratulations again on The Nation Will Follow. I hope everybody will take a look at it. We'll be right back with more with the great Dr. Peter McCullough right after this.
In cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and I say with the greatest of feeling of welcome to our next guest. His name is Dr. Peter McCullough. He has been one of the most extraordinarily courageous medical practitioners in our country, as he has stood up against both considerable pressure on him personally and professionally, as well as all kinds of other assaults on his character and his professionalism, which is all the more extraordinary because he is a highly respected, highly accomplished, highly qualified practitioner as a cardiologist, among other things. He's also the author of this terrific book, The Courage to Face COVID-19. It is about the importance of preventing hospitalization and death while battling the biopharmaceutical complex. He co-authored it with a terrific other guest of ours, John Leek. We're always pleased to have both of them. But Dr. McCullough, especially to have you with us at this time, as so much is going on that I think confirms what you have said from really the get-go of all of this. And yet you are still, as I understand it, under assault. Notably, your board certification and the like. And just give us a little bit of the texture of the challenge that you have faced courageously, as you talk about in your book, and where you stand at the moment with all of this.
Well, Frank, thanks for having me on the show. We've learned to respect the power of what we call the biopharmaceutical complex, this very, very well-coordinated, extremely well-funded syndicate. And we believe at the top is the World Health Organization, the World Economic Forum, Gates Foundation, Wellcome Trust, the Rockefeller Foundation, Gavi, CEPI, which was formed by the Gates Foundation and the World Economic Forum, the Coalition for Epidemic.
Well, these are acronyms for various consortia that help enforce, basically.
Right, but
the World Health Organization.
That's
work,
true,
right?
Frank, but their collective power is extraordinary. They have reached through the media, through government regulatory agencies, through financial institutions, and the suppliers of the wares that the biopharmaceutical complex is really selling out there at premium prices, non-negotiable types of contracts, are the vaccine manufacturers, including Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, Novavax, AstraZeneca, Sinovac, CoronaVac. About a dozen or so vaccines actually used for SARS-CoV-2 in the United States. And what I learned, Frank, is that even the suggestion that we could treat a viral illness, even the suggestion of that very early on was in the crosshairs. And this was well planned. There were 36 pandemic preparedness planning events from 2012 forward, as chronicled by Dr. Peter Bregan in his book, 25 of which were written down, meeting notes, and 6 are filmed. You can just watch them, including Event 201, which occurred in 2019. And we now know through the testimony of CDC Director Redfield that Event 201, which was carried out, the head of the Chinese CDC, Dr. Anthony Fauci, Dr. Ashish Jha, they all participated in this. This was occurring while the virus was already out of the lab in Wuhan, China. So it wasn't a tabletop exercise. It was an in-the-open display of what was going to happen. And in there was powerful censorship of any voices that were going to go against the narrative.
Yeah. And this is one of the things that they intend to do with the World Health Organization's empowerment, if that were to come to pass. I mean, I want to come back to that. But just staying with the travails and the saga of your own personal experience with all of this, the extent to which, as you just said, the opportunity to use readily available, well-tested, and inexpensive therapies early on to essentially snuff this virus is one of the greatest scandals of all time. And it was perpetrated, as you've said so well, by this biopharmaceutical complex and the state apparatuses that join forces with it. Just if you would quickly, sir, at the risk of having you further lashed for your honesty, ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine as examples of those therapies, your thoughts about the fact that they were so rigorously suppressed, at least in this country, and what we saw with their application elsewhere.
It's true. You know, from the very top, Frank, we learned that even nasal sprays, virucidal nasal sprays, dilute povidone iodine, dilute hydrogen peroxide, colloidal silver, xylitol, they were actively suppressed by the FDA and the Federal Trade Commission. We have a chapter in our book on this. So even nasal sprays, Congresswoman Nancy Mace went absolutely wild when she learned the government was suppressing simple nasal sprays, which were effective in reducing the frequency, the intensity, and duration of the illness. Certainly hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, vilified Paxlovid that came through the government development was also undermined by the CDC. Molnupiravir, monoclonal antibodies, safe and effective, hard to get, constantly taken off the market. Everything, Frank, that could help patients was undermined, I think, in order to prepare the world to accept repeated mass vaccination.
Yeah. And with these so-called vaccines that were actually exotic gene therapies, highly experimental, inadequately tested, and it turns out dangerous in many cases. No?
Certainly so. The biological development of messenger RNA in a paper by Lalani and colleagues chronicled that the United States has had a love affair with this space-age technology that would use computers to generate genetic code and then rapidly make ribonucleic acid strings and then use what's called pseudouridine, which makes them permanent. They're completely synthetic. Inject them in the human body. They go everywhere. And in this case, install the code for the lethal Wuhan spike protein from the virus. So everybody who's taken a vaccine has taken a run with their own death with this spike protein. Sadly, scores have suffered injuries, disabilities, and deaths beyond any medicine we've ever seen on the market. There have been calls worldwide to pull them off the market, not safe for human use.
You said scores, sir. I think it's scores of some vastly larger number, is it not? I mean, do we have really any sense of, quite apart from the numbers that have needlessly died because they didn't get the kinds of therapies that they could have, but the kind of damage that you've been documenting, among others, in terms of the impact of these so-called vaccines, it's hard to get your head around how many people have been afflicted. I'm told, for example, and I want to talk with you a little bit more on the other side of a short break, but about the military. You know, young people who are healthy and therefore very unlikely to be harmed seriously by this disease who've been impacted prodigiously by the vaccines. By some estimates, 1 out of 8, I think, have been so afflicted.
Well, let's just take death. Lieutenant Colonel Teresa Long has testified under oath in the U.S. Senate that more soldiers, young soldiers, have died of the COVID vaccine than any military personnel, including the older administrative personnel, with SARS-CoV-2, the infection. The CDC has recorded now and verified over 17,000 Americans have died shortly after taking the vaccine within a few days. Now, the accepted underreporting factor that's been into FDA testimony on vaccines for VAERS, because we know if we don't have the vaccine card and all the information, we can't report it at the time of death. The underreporting factor is 30, Frank. That puts us at over 500,000 Americans have died within a few days of taking the vaccine. And so the autopsy studies, one by Schwab and one by Chavez, show 70 to 80% of the deaths at autopsy are directly due to the vaccine. So if you apply that information, we would conclude that this is the worst calamity of all time. This is worse than any war we've been involved in.
Man inflicted. And the question, I guess, that your comment begs, sir, is how much did those perpetrating this within the biopharmaceutical complex and its tentacles into the state, how much did they know about these dangers when they were promoting these experimental
vaccines? Recent report from Australia, 2021 document, that was obtained through Freedom of Information indicates that all the governments and the companies knew very early. For instance, Pfizer knew early in 2021 their vaccine was going up into the brain, the heart, the adrenal glands, reproductive organs, that it was destined to cause damage. To load genetic code on lipid nanoparticles for a lethal protein is scientifically a disastrous idea. I published this in The Hill in August of 2020, before they even came out. So I was the only public figure to call it ahead of time. And unfortunately, I was very right on understanding that these were dangerous, were not going to work, and in human populations would suffer greatly.
Yeah. But this is criminal activity. I think it's the only way you can describe it. If they knew it in advance, there would be these kinds of repercussions. Robert Kennedy Jr., of course, has written powerfully about the ability of these pharmaceutical companies in particular to get immunity that has caused them to behave in this reckless fashion. Dr. McCullough, we're going to have to take just a very short break here. When we come back, I want to ask you about Robert Kennedy Jr.'s theory of the case and what has to be done now to try to hold these guys accountable, for one thing, but also to try to help mitigate the damage that's been done to, well, it sounds like countless millions of people. We'll be right back with more with the great Dr. Peter McCullough, the author of The Courage to Face COVID-19. Be right back with more right after this. We'll be right back. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Have you noticed the peculiar reporting about the mass murder at a Nashville elementary school yesterday? It's striking as much for what is not being said as what is. Consider, for example, how this shooting would have been covered if a practicing Christian had attacked a school or other venue populated by so-called transgender individuals instead of the other way around. You can bet the narrative would have been all about the threat posed to a victimized community by militant Christianity, and the perpetrator's character and associates would have been exhaustively critiqued. In this case, we need to examine and determine if government officials' othering of Christians as potential domestic terrorists and violent extremists is contributing to increasing persecution of believers here. Moreover, whether such behavior was a decisive factor in this attack or not, it must be condemned and stopped now. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are visiting with the great Dr. Peter McCullough, the co-author with John Leek of The Courage to Face COVID-19, which talks in detail about what has been done to us by the so-called biopharmaceutical complex and the state apparatuses that have been part of it, the federal government, both in the medical area and the Defense Department, and apparently more. Peter McCullough, again, thank you so much for your time, but most especially thank you for the work that you've been doing to raise the alarm, to speak truth to power consistently. And I know you feel as I do that we just as soon be wrong about the things that we're warning of, because the implications of being right are so horrific. I did want to just ask you, with respect to, in particular, what we've learned about these predictable yet concealed dangers for the disease. Is the evidence now, including from Pfizer's own document dump, such that in your professional judgment, medical professional judgment, not legal, but professional medical judgment, the case is sufficiently clear-cut that culpability for mass murder, in effect, could be charged?
Two crimes.
Against these companies in particular.
Two crimes, I would say. The first is fraud, that the American public and populations worldwide were defrauded. They were defrauded by the presentation of these vaccines, what they would do, their safety profile, and efficacy results. And then the second one is mass negligent homicide, a little different than murder, mass negligent homicide. And the reason why I think these very strong statements are supported is under court order, Pfizer released their dossier. You know, each company for 90 days had to keep track of what was happening. They, it was their responsibility. Pfizer recorded 1,223 deaths that occurred within a few days, sometimes within a few hours of taking their vaccine. Pfizer recorded this, and under court order, they were forced to release it to the public, an NGO, the Public Health Professional Review Committee, of which I'm a member of. And in this process, the lawyer for the FDA wanted to block this release for 55 years. It's on record in federal court. So we have a problem here. Our FDA knew about this, and they attempted to block the information. They should have very early on with Pfizer in January of 2021 pulled these off the market. Something went wrong. They went to multi-use files. They went to mass production of a product that had never been produced before, a brand new genetic technology. It could have been a product problem. We understand that some lots are far more lethal than other lots. Could have been a susceptibility problem, that there are certain people that simply cannot take the vaccines, people with heart disease and blood clotting disorders, and we can go on and on. But this idea of just keep rolling these, and in fact, within a few months, they became mandated with no adjustment and no concern over safety.
And as we talked about briefly a moment ago, this was particularly egregious when the mandates applied to populations that were simply not at real risk. And I this is a program, as you know, Doctor, that focuses mostly on national security matters. But the idea that the United States military, with a cohort of people who were generally in that category of not very susceptible to this disease, were nonetheless afflicted by it. And you talk about people with heart conditions. There are bunches of them that have heart conditions now. As a cardiologist, you understand that better than anybody. Talk a little bit about the damage that that has been done. I'm told that by some estimates, as many as 1 in 8 members of the United States military, including the General Officers Corps, by the way, have been either permanently harmed, killed in some cases outright, or temporarily and severely impaired. Does that sound right to you?
It does. A Zogby survey last summer, a general population survey, revealed 15% of people who take the vaccines have some new medical problem they're grappling with if they've survived it. The CDC VSafe data, which was released to the NGO ICANN, again under court order, found 7.7% of people who take the vaccine are so sick they have to go to the hospital or emergency room. Some are hospitalized with immediate problems. We don't need our military to have anything that makes them acutely sick. They have to have readiness every day. And the types of illnesses are very serious. We're talking about heart damage, myocarditis, blood clots in the brain, stroke, neuropathy. These things affect use of weapon systems, flying airplanes, driving tanks and Humvees. We have grave concerns now that our military's been weakened. It's been twofold. It's not only the biological medical issues of illness and disability, in some cases death, but also the moral hazard and diminution of what's happened here. Military officers and soldiers did not want to take this vaccine, and they faced months of ridicule, humiliation. Some were thrown out of the military. And so the ones who took it under duress, and their will was broken. This is very important. In the military, we actually build up strength of character and strength of conviction. And in this case, our military officers now are mentally and physically weakened by this vaccine program.
Right. And confidence in their leadership, good order and discipline, morale, unit cohesion, all of those have been impacted. In fact, as you know, Doctor, there are some who believe that the vaccine, not just the disease, was a biological weapon. And if it targeted only the United States military with these kinds of effects, it has been incalculably successful. And I fear has only emboldened the source, namely the Chinese Communist Party, to redouble their efforts in the biological warfare space. And I did want to just ask you, sir, based on your study of the matter and your medical training, what you've described is a horror story. And it's my understanding that any other vaccine that had had anything remotely like these kinds of effects would have been pulled almost instantaneously. And in some cases, that was the past experience. We have to take another short break. On the other side of it, I want to ask you a little bit about that, but also to invite you to talk a little bit about your personal experience here and what is continuing to happen to you for standing up for America against the onslaught of the biopharmaceutical complex, the subject of your terrific book, The Courage to Face COVID-19. We'll be right back with more. Dr. Peter McCullough, right after this. Welcome back. Dr. Peter McCullough is in the house, a renowned and highly regarded medical practitioner who has, among other things, and you can find his writings in all kinds of places, but the book with John Leek is extraordinarily important. The courage to face COVID-19. And I want to talk to you a little bit about your courage and what's flowed from it, sir, in a moment. But before we do, just on this question of what went wrong with the oversight process, with the quality control mechanisms that have historically pulled off the market, prevented, you know, people from getting, let alone being required to get, dangerous vaccines or other drugs. What's your assessment of the source of that particular problem and how dramatically it departed from previous experience and practice?
The source was the merged leadership of the vaccine program was the FDA and the CDC. Those organizations should not be leading the clinical program. The FDA is supposed to be the watchdog, the safety watchdog. They can't be put in a position to promote a biopharmaceutical. They're simply going to be, you know, following marching orders. The emergency use authorization.
Well, especially if their funding comes from Big Pharma, which is
Big
a
Pharma,
revelation.
You know, and from the government. Remember, the order came down from the White House, Health and Human Services, Department of Defense. It was the DOD and HHS that rolled out the vaccines. They're rolled out under a military mechanism, which is the emergency use authorization. That is a military mechanism. The PREP Act was utilized. The PREP Act is a national security operation. And the PREP Act lists on its website since 2005, you know, a dozen or more biological threats where this would happen. Anthrax, smallpox, Marburg, it would happen again, where the nation's national security apparatus, not public health measures, but national security was operationalized. The vaccines are considered military countermeasures. This is very important. These are not subject to FDA debate and withdrawal or any type of vetting of safety information. This is a full out, in a sense, we're at war. We're at declared war with a virus, SARS-CoV-2. For 3 years now, our governments have maintained both national emergencies and public health emergencies. So at the presidential level and Secretary HHS level, Frank, this is an all-out go with no signs of stopping. And even when the emergency use authorization is planned to actually be retired, the emergency measure declarations are planned to be retired in May of 2023. The authorizations through EUA for these products are said right now to continue.
Wow. You know, I monitor National Public Radio, which I often consider to be enemy broadcasting. And just this morning, they were talking about how the medical community is divided between those who think we just have to keep getting these boosters, the jab, into people's arms relentlessly. Some of them were concerned that we were going to exceed their useful life, so we better use them rather than lose them. And then some others said, well, actually, it's vaccinating for a variant of this disease that no longer exists, or it's no longer at least a problem. Just quickly on this, sir, because it's highly technical, but it's vital that we understand. Is it the case today that we are being forced to take, in some cases, you know, with punishments, you know, that are can be quite draconian? And I want to talk to you about your own personal experience in this regard. A vaccine that is not only not effective, not only not relevant to the present strains of this thing we're at war with, but also is so harmful. This seems to have just completely left the rails in terms of sound public policy.
The vaccine program has left the rails. It's been a disastrous campaign. There were no randomized trials demonstrating reductions in hospitalizations, deaths as a primary and secondary endpoint. Now, University of Maryland has a report out anchored by senior author Peter Doshi, indicating even the non-randomized studies were completely biased and were false, you know, trying to proclaim a benefit of the vaccines. Even the bivalent boosters are coded against BA4, BA5. We haven't had that variant strain in circulation now for over 6 months. We're on to XBB1. The bivalent boosters have no studies suggesting they can stop the current variant. All we have is toxicity and harm. People need to know this. I, under oath in the Texas and the U.S. Senate, as well as the Texas Senate in the last year, have said, listen, we need to pull these off the market.
Yeah, amen. Very quickly, sir, you have had your board certification, as I understand it, pulled because you've had the courage to face COVID-19 and speak as frankly as you have done with us today. Where does that stand? Is this appealable? You're a very important medical practitioner, needless to say, and it's a travesty what's being done to you.
I'm in active clinical practice now, and I have maintained my board certifications. I am under threat of decertification by the American board. I've appealed. That appeal now has been delayed. I can tell you I remain, I have a resolve of steel, undaunted. I will prevail here. There is no such thing as COVID misinformation. Just on this interview, like on others, I meticulously cite the data and I will prevail. And I think the board, as well as boards all over the country, are going to regret coming after doctors who are speaking the truth.
Well, praise God. I had thought things had already gone in that very unhappy direction, but if not yet, and hopefully it will not come to pass. But again, you have been involved with other medical doctors. Is there an organization that you would particularly like to commend to people's attention as a resource?
The lead organization is the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, chartered 1943, every state in the United States. It strongly supported medical freedom for doctors to take care of patients, as well as advocating for patients to have a say in their healthcare. So aapsonline.org.
Good. I promised our audience that you would talk about the World Health Organization, so we're going to have you back to visit with us, if you will do so, about the inadvisability of giving them more power to impose this biopharmaceutical complex on us. But in the meantime, thank you, Dr. Peter McCullough. You are an inspiration as well as a wonderful guest. We look forward to our next visit with you. We look forward to talking to the rest of you again next time. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Go forth and multiply.